This is Robert Stark, and I'm here with a returning guest, Luke Ford. Luke, nice having you back on for just one more show.
Good to talk to you, Robert.
And you have a new show. Every Sunday you have a Torah talk show with your new co-host.
Yes. Yeah, it's exciting. Each week we talk about the weekly Torah portion. Refers specifically to the five books of Moses, and it's divided up into weekly portions. So right now we're going through the book of Leviticus, and we apply it to modern day issues of race and nationalism and Jewish Gentile relations. And when I listen to Jewish talks or when I study Jewish texts, I always think, well, what if Gentiles acted this way? Or would this be a good model for, say, white people to use to develop their national identity? And so that's the perspective that I'm using, directing on these weekly Torah talks.
And what are some of the responses that you've been getting? I think the show is the first, it's basically the first show that talks about both Jewish religious texts and basically like the type of dissident politics, like your two main interests.
Yeah, well, for me, the show combines white nationalism with Jewish nationalism, and I try to explore where they're complementary, where they are at odds, and so far I've been getting nothing but positive responses, because my co-host is this very hot 25-year-old blonde Jewish gal who's also interested in issues of race and white nationalism and the Dark Enlightenment. And
she's kind of like a young female version of Luke Ford.
Yes, she is. We think in very similar ways. So it also helps that she's young and hot. So people like to tune in and to engage with her in particular. She's already had one marriage proposal.
And you're not going to say if it's from you or not.
It was not from me.
What is that thing? Is it Chaim Amalek said something? Oh, you were talking about how your friends are always trying to set you up with age-appropriate women. And who's that? The Chaim Amalek is something like, oh, age-appropriate women never smile.
Well, there is just like a cultish vitality to my co-host. I mean, if you just look at the way her facial muscles work, I mean, she's so young and fresh. She's 25. You know, she's got this wonderful mane of fake blonde hair. I mean, she's lithe. She's flexible. She's slim. She's just, you know, still excited about life. She laughs a lot. She's emotional. Like, she's everything that you'd want in a woman and in a Torah Talks co-host. So everyone responds very favorably to her. And she's quite brave, because very few women, only one woman in 100, is willing to buck the group norms. So women tend to be very sensitive to group norms and to fitting in. And they mainly just, you know, do that, you know, you go girl type attitude, and they never risk saying anything dangerous or edgy, because that might diminish their social status or their connections with their friends and family and community. So women very rarely think outside the box. You know, women and girls very much color inside the lines of what is socially permissible. So to get a young, hot co-host who thinks heretical thoughts, who thinks independently, is a very difficult find, because almost every woman simply regurgitates the conventional wisdom. Now, it's very rare that you find a woman who's got an articulate political philosophy. Now, maybe one woman in 1,000. So it's another reason why I think giving women the vote has just been an absolute disaster. It's bad for women, it's bad for America, it's bad for countries in general. Like, women should exercise their political persuasion in the bedroom and the kitchen as God and nature intended.
And I like the way you're talking about her facial expressions, how her facial expressions react to what you say. Like, whether she's, like, smiling, and then you say something, like, really cringeworthy.
Yeah. You must have watched some of the shows then.
The last show, she's like, oh, I'm not responsible for anything that Luke Forbes has to say.
Yeah, she kind of, she said, I went too far when I said that fat Jews need to be sent to camps where they, you know, have to do a lot of physical labor and go on a restricted diet. She thought that was like in bad taste. She thought that was way too far. She thought that was not cool. And I think she gets a little uncomfortable when I go after Jewish communal organizations. And a lot of my humor does, you know, shock and occasionally appall her. So it is really fun to do the show. And because there's a little bit of a time gap, you know, I'll be saying a joke and, you know, I'll just be waiting for, you know, when she's cracking up. And it's also inspiring for me. I'd much rather be talking to a hot young chick. You know, I mean, you're a fine gentleman, Robert Stark, but, you know, I'd rather you're a hot young female chick who was interviewing me and asking me my thoughts about life. So getting to talk and see her on the screen there, you know, with that coltish vitality and the young, fresh, good looks. And she's so responsive, like her face is, you know, changing with every thought and every emotion that she feels. She's a wonderful muse for me.
Maybe you should do like a blog post of every single one of her facial expressions and then put which Luke Ford quote it's in reaction to.
Oh, yeah. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you always... And you said, oh, you compared her to the Oregon State Library Cam Girl.
Oh, yeah, she looks just like the Oregon State Library Cam Girl. Remember that Oregon State Library Cam Girl? She was, like, very voluptuous. And even though my co-host dresses in a very modest way, discerning viewers can tell that she's also a very voluptuous woman. She's got a similar smile to the Oregon Cam Girl. And she's like a dead ringer for the Oregon Cam Girl. In fact, for all people know, she may be the Oregon Cam Girl.
Well, you still, I mean, you were a porn journalist at one time, so you still have that. That's always going to be part of who you are and how you do your interviews.
Well, I tried to restrain that when I was interviewing Paul Gottfried and Kevin MacDonald.
Yeah, you're probably not going to want to ask Kevin MacDonald about those kind of questions.
I tried to keep things on a very lofty level when I was talking to Kevin MacDonald, to Paul Gottfried, and to who's that guy from Croatia who came over?
Tom Sunic. Yeah.
I tried to lift my game a notch.
And on your Torah talk, you've covered a lot of different things. You did another Sam Vaknin video about the narcissist and how the narcissist, their relationship with God.
Yeah. Yeah, so narcissist and God is just a great, great discussion point because the God is basically everything that, you know, the narcissist wishes he could be. You know, the narcissist is... you know, wishing to be all powerful, to be everywhere, to just have like godlike powers, to be worshipped, and so God, you know, has those powers, and a lot of religious leaders are narcissists because look, a narcissist. What is a narcissist? A narcissist is an attention-seeking machine. The narcissist will assume any personality, any shape, take on any profession that he can, any persona, depending on what will get him the most attention. So God is regarded by believers as omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, admired, much discussed, awe-inspiring. So God is the narcissist's wet dream. God is like the narcissist's ultimate fantasy. Now, a narcissist tends to idealize and devalue people, particularly great authority figures, particularly people like God. So in an idealization phase, you know, the narcissist will try to imitate authority figures such as rabbis, priests, ministers, or God, and believe that these authority figures can do no wrong, that they're bigger than life, they're bold, brilliant, and perfect. And then as the narcissist's unrealistic expectations are inevitably defeated by reality, he begins to devalue his former idols, and they're stupid, and they're dumb, and they're mediocre. And the narcissist goes through that same relationship with God. Like, if you'd encountered me 30 years ago, is 1990, so how long ago was 1990? That was 25 years ago. You know, I would have been like the most God intoxicated person you could have met. And, you know, I was just like all rah-rah Judaism, rabbis and Torah and God, that's where it's at. And then, of course, you know, I fell off the wagon a few times with the ladies. I started writing on the porn industry. You know, I alienated myself from my religious community. And so, you know, I would go through phases where I devalue God, become disillusioned with God and with religion. You know, I become filled with despair. And yet I converted to this strange new religion. Yet I converted to Orthodox Judaism. So I can't deny this, because I have staked my whole life on my conversion to Orthodox Judaism, this radical change. So what do you do when you're filled with despair and yet you've converted to Orthodox Judaism and most of your social circle are Orthodox Jews? So a narcissist either is in a very difficult spot there. So for me, I found some help through many, many, many years of psychotherapy, about 10 years of psychotherapy now and 5 years of 12-step work. And I've been able to become more attuned to spotting narcissism, not just in myself, but in other people. So when I encounter a religious leader who's looking for obedient and unquestioning slaves, someone who's constantly preying on the gullible, or someone who uses his religious flock as his hostages, someone who's constantly seeking narcissistic supply, a religious leader, a rabbi who's craving attention, adulation, affirmation, and applause, and we in the audience are his source of narcissistic supply, then, you know, I realize that's a very dangerous person. So there are a lot of narcissists in positions of religious leadership, and I enjoy writing about them.
Have you seen it more in Orthodox Judaism or the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which you grew up with?
I think it's pretty evenly distributed. Just like child sex abusers, I think it's pretty evenly distributed, whether we're talking rabbis, priests, ministers, plumbers, lawyers, baseball players. My anecdotal impression is that this kind of narcissism is evenly distributed in the religions and in religious leaders, as I think child sexual abuse, you know, it seems to infect every facet of the world.
And you got into this topic on your new Torah talk show, but you and your co-host discussed your concept called the Torah Corral. And is this something that you came up with, or someone else did, or is this your unique Luke Ford concept?
Let's just say that Chaim Amalek, I channeled Chaim Amalek, and
I thought Chaim Amalek was you. I thought that was like a fake profile you came up with as an alter ego.
Well, let's just say Chaim Amalek is like a part of Luke Ford that he cannot deny. So the Torah Corral is this idea that when God created the world, he chose the Jews to be humanity's master race. But seeing that creating this very intelligent group of people would have nastier results with a less intelligent Goyim of creation, God saw that he needed to fence the Jews in with a corral. And so he gave them the Torah, both written and oral, so that they could be fenced in, and yet everyone could still have free will. So Jews who live in the Torah Corral, we're no threat to the gentle Gentiles of the world. It's the secular liberal left-wing Jew with his notions of Marxism, his tolerance of the sodomite and the transgendered, the creator of socialism and feminism. This type of Jew is the enemy of the Gentile world. So if the Goyim ever wake up from their deep moral stupor and begin dealing with the Jewish problem in their midst, I hope that they will leave me and other Torah Jews alone and go after those left-wing communist Jews pushing feminism and gay rights and rights for trannies and rights for civil rights for blacks and Latinos and more third world immigration. Like, those kind of Jews are a disaster for not just the Jewish people, but for America and for the world.
And I guess you'd probably say that a lot of the self-appointed leaders of a lot of these organizations don't live within the Torah corral. Like the groups you're talking about that promote amnesty.
You know, I wish that was true. And I kind of assumed that was true. And it's really painful for me to admit that's not as clearly true as I wish it was. Unfortunately, and I'm just so appalled by this, every single significant Jewish organization in America, every major Jewish organization from secular and left-wing to right-wing and orthodox, promotes and pushes for immigration amnesty and more immigration into America. It's just a disaster. And these groups are, let's call them for what they are, these groups are traitors. These groups are out to destroy the United States of America. There is no other way to look at it. Let me just read you a couple of sentences from the immigration policy of Agudas Yisrael. Now, Agudas Yisrael is a very right-wing, very orthodox Jewish group, and it urges that American borders continue to be open to refugees who seek to come to the United States. The United States is a nation of immigrants. Been long distinguished by its generosity towards refugees from all across the globe. It is essential that such generosity continue to be maintained. Agudat Israel accordingly opposes any efforts to impose any caps, any quotas on refugees seeking safe haven in the United States. And Agudat Israel further supports the provision of welfare benefits to needy non-citizen immigrants. So they want all the world's refugees who are fleeing political oppression, which is probably, what, 1 billion, 2 billion, 3 billion people, to be allowed to come to the United States and get welfare, even if they come here illegally, even if they're not citizens. It's just a disaster. And every single major Jewish organization pushes for this. So from my perspective, every single major Jewish organization is dedicated and fights for the destruction of the historic American nation, for the destruction of the United States of America. And I am implacably opposed to every single major Jewish organization with its jihad for immigration amnesty and for the destruction of the historic white American nation.
Maybe you and your co-host and maybe some other individuals such as Paul Gottfried should get together and start a new organization.
Yeah, well, I've started, at least on my blog, an organization called Jews for Consistency. And so that's where we demand that Jewish organizations never seek for Gentiles anything that they don't want for themselves. Currently in the world today, Jewish organizations, the big ones, all push for more and more multiculturalism, multiracialism for the non-Jewish nations of the world, while reserving the benefits, seeking to reserve the benefits of group unity and group cohesion for the Jewish state and for the Jewish people. So I'm trying to follow Jewish organizations such as the ADL and the Agudas Yisrael and the Orthodox Union and the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU and the Simon Wiesenthal Center to follow this rule. Never seek something different for non-Jews that you don't seek for Jews. So it's good that all groups pursue their group interest, but not when they're pursuing their group interest being hypocritical about it by pushing, you know, unlimited immigration on America, but not pushing for unlimited immigration into Israel. So Jewish organizations usually frame their moral demands using the language of universal moral principles, because they know if they push it by saying this is good for the Jews, that's not going to be effective. But they keep pushing this multiculturalism and unlimited immigration and third world immigration and more rights for minority groups, all at the expense of the white majority, while at the same time they seek the benefits of ethnic unity for Jews. They don't criticize Israel, which set up a very nasty fence to keep out illegal immigrants. Israel seeks to deport African immigrants back to Africa, or they put them in prison out in the desert in a very, you know, inhospitable place. So, you know, if Jewish organizations want to protest anti-Jewish sentiments, what they call anti-Semitism, they should first protest Jews making negative comments about non-Jews. Now, I don't think Jews are the embodiment of the evil principle. You know, I don't think Jews are inherently bad. I see Jews as having the characteristics of all strongly identifying in-groups, only they tend to have higher IQs, they tend to have more energy and more drive and more success than other in-groups. So if Jewish organizations want to protest about anti-Semitic comments in Christianity or Islam or in non-Jewish life, they should first devote their efforts to tracking anti-Gentile sentiments in Jewish texts. Now, there are lots of anti-Gentile sentiments in Jewish texts, not because Jews are evil, but because all strong in-group identities have negative feelings about out-groups. So to the extent that blacks have a strong in-group identity, they have negative feelings about non-blacks. To the extent that Muslims have a strong in-group identity, they will tend to have a lot of suspicions, negative feelings towards non-Muslims. To the extent that gays have a very strong gay identity, they will tend to have a negative or suspicious view of non-gays. So, you know, let Jews clean up their own tradition. If they want to start censoring hate speech, as Jewish organizations have pushed for racial vilification laws in Australia and England and France, let them first apply those laws to their own sacred texts, and we would have to start censoring the Torah and the Talmud and the ongoing rabbinic tradition, which contains a great number of anti-Gentile sentiments.
Was there a case in Australia where this woman was, she said something how we don't need any Muslim immigrants in this country, and she was thrown in jail?
Yeah, there was a woman in Ipswich, and I once had a girlfriend in Ipswich, so this, you know, this really hits home. Like, Ipswich is a working class suburb outside of Brisbane, Australia, and this working, I assume she's working class girl from Ipswich, posted on Facebook to this radical Muslim lawyer in Australia. First of all, this Muslim lawyer went on a jihad against a very popular Australian t-shirt that said, Australia, love it or leave it. And she accused that t-shirt of being racist and promoting xenophobia. So in response, this commonsensical woman from Ipswich wrote, why don't you raghead, why don't you go back to your sand dune country? And that's a crime now in Australia. She's being arraigned in court for breaking the racial vilification laws. I tell you, it was not like that when I grew up. When I grew up, before my parents would serve me breakfast, I had to chant, ragheads, go back to your sand dune country. And me and my mates, we had to go out and find a pufter and tie him up to our ute. That's a utility vehicle, what Americans call an SUV, and drag him for a couple of kilometers until he's willing to abandon his pufter ways. So now all the things that I loved to do when I was growing up in Australia, they're now all illegal.
So you have this post, you ponder the question, what is the difference between a blogger and a suicide bomber?
Oh boy. Yeah, that's a painful question. So what the prominent bloggers and suicide bombers and this German Wings pilot who drove his plane, you know, into the Alps, and this Elliot Rodger who went on the killing spree in Santa Barbara, is that all these groups tend to be social misfits. They're not connected normally and healthfully to other people or to themselves. So someone like me, I've battled with narcissism all of my life, and that means I'm an attention-seeking junkie who will assume any shape in order to get more and more attention, seeking adulation and a following. And we often tend to put enormous efforts into our online work because we're failing in real life. So we create this fantasy world or this online world, this virtual world, where we seek adulation, attention, and strokes, and to be noticed and to feel like we matter. Because down deep, we fear that we don't matter. In the dark night of the soul, we fear we don't matter. My computer crashed about 5 days ago. And so I've basically been without a computer the past 5 days. And it's just been hell, because so much of my self-esteem and so much of, you know, what I think about, what I want to do is on the computer. Now, I feel like I'm in a good groove with my postings of late, and so I really want to keep it going, because I have this fantasy that I'll meet some great woman through this, and I'll get married, and I'll make more money, and I'll receive the respect and recognition that I deserve. And I have all these fantasies that get robbed away from me when you take away the computer. So many bloggers such as myself, we have tendencies to misanthropy, to, you know, basically hating humanity, tendencies towards hating ourselves. We've failed to launch basically into life. Our peers have married and had children and secured mortgages and are moving ahead in their professions and have honored positions in the community. And most of us bloggers, such as myself, have none of those things. So,
and this is something, I mean, it takes a lot of openness to admit that you have similarities to individuals who basically are mass murderers. That's an uncomfortable, would be an uncomfortable admission for a lot of people. But what you say in that post is basically say we're both disposable.
Yeah, we feel so disposable. That's something that haunts me. Like if I died, you know, who would miss me? Like I don't have kids. I don't have a spouse. I don't have an honored position in the community. Like the synagogues I go to, they don't accept me. They think I'm a loser. And I am. I'm the biggest loser at almost every synagogue I go to. Compared to everyone else, I'm far more of a failure in life than anyone else in the shul. So, you know, wherever I go in the Jewish community, you know, they know me as a failure and as a loser. And outside the Jewish community, I don't have any of the trappings of success. And so that can provoke a desire to lash out. And at times I have lashed out of that anger. I've just been driven to tear people down. And I've tried to channel it within ethical means so that I only tore down people who deserved it. But I said a lot of inappropriate things that I've regretted over the years, just, you know, nasty, vile, misogynistic, misanthropic sentiments that kind of embarrass me now. When I find them on my blog, I go, oh, you know, I better edit that out. I better cut that down. But, you know, at the core is this despair, this, you know, dark night of the soul, dark cloud that hangs over one's psyche. And, you know, sometimes I'll go to synagogue and think, you know, does anyone here like me? You know, does anyone here care about me? But the great rejoinder is, well, do I care about anyone there? Have I shown anyone there that I care about them? Have I done anything for anyone there? Am I extending myself to other people? So that's where I have to get out of the narcissistic trap. And, you know, instead of just thinking, why isn't anyone coming over to see how I'm doing? Why isn't anyone greeting me? Why isn't anyone engaging with me? I have to turn that around and go, okay, why aren't I engaging with other people? Why aren't I helping other people? Why aren't I extending myself and reaching out to others and trying to make the lives of other people a little easier and better? So that's, you know, one of the benefits of many years of therapy is that I'll go into therapy. For instance, about a month ago, I went into therapy and said to my therapist, oh, you know, my friend, he really needs to be in therapy because he needs a therapist to just slice him open and, you know, make him cry and, you know, let him get down to the core essentials so he can't keep living in this narcissistic delusion. And so after I got off my soapbox, my therapist said to me, well, let me slice you open. And so that's something that you get in therapy. Like I was in therapy and I was complaining about this party I'd gone to. And I said, oh, there were these two girls. It was so stupid when they saw each other. They gave this squeal and they dropped their expensive purses and they ran over to each other and gave each other hugs. And they were just squealing the whole time. Squeal, squeal, squeal. It was just so stupid. All right. So my therapist said, well, did you wish that you had someone that you could have, you know, been squealing and hugging and have such joy with? And it's like, yeah. And it's because I didn't have that connection, that squealing and that joy and that thrill of seeing one and being bonded with someone, that I was then tempted to go, oh, all these other people are stupid. Go ahead.
So what you're basically saying, and I mean, I'll be honest, I've certainly felt the same way as you with a lot of my, and that's probably why I'm drawn to your blog. But with you put all that energy into your blogging, but you're saying some people who with issues of narcissism and feelings of emptiness, a lot of these mass murderers you're talking about fit that profile. What do you know so much about the guy in Germany? I know he was suffering from depression. Do you think a lot of it was like growing up, he had this dream that, oh, I was going to be a big pilot and everyone would worship me and think I'm fantastic? And
I don't know a lot about the pilot in Germany. I only know the things I read, but one, you know, forms an impression of some sort of psychological break with reality. One forms the impression that he'd just been dumped by his girlfriend. So for me, when my computer broke down over the past 5 days, it was like a death, because I know this is sad and pathetic to say, the most important relationship I have in my life is with my computer. And when it's gone, I was just left bereft and lonely. And so at other times in my life, my most important relationship has been my romantic one. And when it was troubled, or when she broke up with me, I've just been devastated, just absolutely rocked to my very core, and just, you know, just like falling into the void. Or when I've been kicked out of a synagogue, again, it felt identically like I was just falling into a dark void, that all the shattering losses of my childhood getting mixed around in like a washing machine, and just everything's just getting whirled and whirled around, and all those childhood losses just seem to build and even build in intensity, so that they're even more painful and more intense and more confusing than they were when I was 5 and 6. So that's the kind of vibe that I get off this German Wings pilot, that he was dumped by his girlfriend, that he sounds like he found out that she was pregnant by some other dude. Sound like he was surfing online for gay porn, so someone struggling with his identity, and someone who sounds like he had a psychological break. He was, sounds like he was schizophrenic or something. So these are not a good combos. But you know, when I have that dark night of the soul, which basically happens whenever I can't distract myself with other pursuits, such as blogging, or such as being entertained by a book I'm reading, or a movie that I'm watching, or by friends or some kind of human connection. When I can't be distracted by that, and I just have nothing but myself, and being 48 years of age, and just like looking at where I am in life, it's horrifying, and it's like being lost in a dark void. And you know, I do all this psychological work and all this 12-step work, and you know, yet again and again I have to confront the void. At least now I have more tools to deal with it, so I will tune into a 12-step lecture, I'll pull out my 12-step workbook and start working some exercises. I'll write it all out in my journal. When I write out my despair, I find that helps to let it go. Or I'll talk to people, which is probably the most effective way for me to deal with my despair, such as by going to a 12-step meeting, or going to therapy, or just talking to my friends or acquaintances and just sharing with them a little bit about what's going on. You know, not dumping on people, you know, making sure that they're in a space where they can hear what's going on with me. And then as I can articulate it, it seems to diminish the despair.
And does religion or spirituality help you a lot, or not always?
Both. It helps me, but not always. And it's just one form of connection that most people need. It's also at least as important, even more important, to have human connection. And a great thing about religion is that it provides perhaps the most effective way for most people to organize their lives and to be part of a community, and to have, you know, frequent interactions with other people with whom they have things in common. So for instance, as an Orthodox Jew, you pray in a minyan, which is a prayer quorum of at least 10 men, 3 times a day. So that's a great way to get human connection. You just show up to minyan. Or I go to a daily Talmud class. Again, human connection and camaraderie, male bonding, it's all men and we're gathered together and we're studying this text. So I think Orthodox Judaism, better than any religion I know, provides all sorts of ways to connect. A friend of mine lost his father, and so I paid a shiva call on Sunday night. I went to his apartment, and there are other people paying a shiva call, you know, condolences. And there was a lot of human connection there. There were girls there. There were guys there. Then we gathered together, say, the afternoon evening prayers. There was lots of food. So again, it's that vital human connection the people like myself who feel like we weren't given the guidebook for how to interact with life, that everybody else, you know, has gotten the rule book, and you know, I will often feel lost. Well, at least in Orthodox Judaism, many of these rules are written out.
You have this post on your blog, and this is in reference to the suicide bomber. But what is this? This is concept called, and basically, I know that I haven't heard this term, but I'm aware of the overall concept. But it's called the scale problem. What is the scale problem? And it says by scale, I'll read you what it says. It means more than mere population growth. I refer to the scale of complexity created by the West's conversion to a multicultural, globalized social model. In this model, all distinctions, including race, meaning ethnicity, nationality, culture, and religion, are viewed as subordinate between the managerial class and the managed class. This effective democracy is blunted, and the masses of people are shifted and reorganized in accordance with the decisions of the managerial class.
Yeah, well, scale means that we're no longer a homogeneous, organically linked society. And so it's possible to thrive in a multicultural, multiracial society, but it's a lot more difficult, and more people will get left behind, alienated, and kind of floating in a void. So, for instance, in Australia, there's much more of a homogeneous society, and there's much more of a natural sense of connection, because 90% of the country is white. And imagine how much more bonded it was in the first half of the 20th century, when it was 99% white. And America used to be 90% white until about 1965. So when you share a common genetics, then it's much easier to bond. So we find in nature and among people what Phil Rushton outlined as genetic similarity theory. The more you have in common genetically, the more willing you are to sacrifice for someone else, and the more likely you are to get along with someone else, the more genetically you have in common. But in America today, that's just been trashed by all this non-white immigration. So people increasingly have no community outside of their immediate family, and they may have, you know, a terrible relationship with their family. The implicit, you know, contracts of human relationships have kind of been voided and severed, and there's just so much freedom and so much anarchic possibility that it just chews people up. And it used to be that people were expected to get married, but now women are waiting longer and longer, trying to just get, you know, that top 5% alpha male. And then by the time they're 30, 35, they're hitting the wall, they've lost their looks, and no alpha male is gonna marry them. So the more society becomes dislocated, the less frequently people marry and raise children, then the more you have these anatomized individuals just kind of floating in a void. And then people in a void do crazy, crazy things. Like, I know for me, the most significant factor on whether I'm acting in a socially constructive way is whether I'm connected to other people. The more isolated I get, the weirder I get, the more despair I feel, the more morally troublesome the things I write and the things I do. So it's so important to be bonded to others, and we know from Robert Putnam's studies of diversity and its effect on community, the more racially diverse a community, the less social capital, the less people trust each other, the more people isolate and spend their spare time watching television. While in states such as Oregon and cities such as Portland that are overwhelmingly white, people have much more connection with their neighbors, they engage much more in voluntary civic projects. You have a lot more volunteering in those cities that are overwhelmingly white, while in Australia's most diverse city, Sydney, you have the least amount of volunteering. And in America, it's in those cities and states that are the least white where you have the least volunteering and the least social capital.
Isn't Germany where the pilot was from, is still a fairly homogeneous country?
Yes, so genetic similarity does not explain everything. for instance, India has a tremendous amount of genetic diversity, and yet it's a relatively peaceful country. On the other hand, Africa is the most genetically diverse, racially diverse continent in the world, and it has the most conflict and genocides. So generally speaking, the more genetic similarity, the more social capital. But this is not the, you know, the only explanation for how the world works. So yeah, this pilot was German, and he came from a overwhelmingly homogenous society. So even people from homogenous societies do terrible things.
And do you see similarities in Muslim suicide bombers, like the 9/11 hijackers?
Yeah, well, these are usually, suicide bombers are usually the dregs of society. They're people who want to feel popular, who are assured that, you know, they will have 70 virgins in heaven, they will, their families will be honored, that their memories will be honored. And I understand that. Like, there's so much in my life, I would have been willing to just do anything to have been thought cool, to just, you know, belong to the cool crowd, even if only in memory, that, you know, Luke Ford was a cool person. I remember one stage I was willing to, like, donate a lung to help a friend, because I thought that, you know, people would admire me for my selflessness and for saving my friend's life. So I've forgotten the question.
Oh, yeah, the question is, there's you sort of basically answered it, but you would basically say that the profile of Muslim suicide bombers, like the 9/11 hijackers, fits that.
Yeah. If you show your rejects, your community's rejects, the losers, that they can become cool, most people will go for it. So if you tell them that by committing suicide, by blowing themselves up in the midst of the enemy, they will have eternal life and they will be regarded as heroes of their people, that's a very appealing prospect for losers. And most suicide bombers are losers. So if you simply understand that everybody wants to be cool, that everybody wants to move up in social status, then you're going to understand a heck of a lot in life. Now, almost everything that people do is striving to avoid shame and humiliation and instead to move up in social status.
Okay, what is your opinion of the Royce site that you linked to? First of all, I'll read you what Chaim Amalek wrote. He says, "This is a very sad website, and reading a website like this for tips on how to get sexually desirable women is like a Hasidic Rebbe looking to a goy snake-handling Pentecostalist preacher for insight into Mishnah."
Okay, so I think the website, it's hartiste.wordpress.com, Royce's site, I think it's often brilliant. I think it's a great website, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea for everybody to read it, or even for most people to read it on a regular basis. I think there's a lot of great knowledge there. I do think that playing the game, which is using seduction techniques to get more and more women into bed, tends to feed addictions, sex and love addictions, that it tends to make men more cynical, more users of other people. So I'm not sure how good the game is, the seduction game is for most men. Certainly, we can all use help with our social skills and for more clearly understanding how women operate, because most men tend to be absolutely clueless about what attracts a woman. So yeah, I think it's a great website, and also I'm not sure it's the best reading material on a regular basis for many guys. It may feed some of their more manipulative and callous instincts, but I have great respect for the website.
And yeah, he writes a lot about the topics that you were writing about. And oh, he wrote this one about the suicide bomber. Oh, he says an intersection of homosexuality and schizophrenia is the most recent one that you linked to.
Yeah, I think he's very sharp insights. And, you know, this is something I also noticed in the pornography industry. Some of the most evil people that I met in the pornography industry, just, you know, bone-chillingly evil people, had incredibly sharp insights. So I'm not saying Royce is evil, but often people who you know, one would be tempted to just dismiss, often have very sharp insights. So people, you know, in the seduction community often have very sharp insights into social skills, into how people work, you know, how men tick, because, you know, the dirty dark truth about human nature is that we're motivated by very selfish, nasty, unenlightened motivations much of the time. And someone like Royce puts his finger right on it. I found over the course of my life that evil people have at least as many insights into how the world works as good people. Often good people are totally clueless.
I also think that nihilism allows, in a sense, nihilism and absence of moral restrictions allows people to be totally honest about human nature. I think things like religion and morality cause people to want to sort of cover up the dark aspects of a human nature.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. Like, people feel pretty honest and free on Royce's website to describe the world as they see it without the compunctions of organized religion and social acceptability.
Oh, and you linked to another one of his articles. He had one called, is this gendered racial exclusion by white internet daters? Oh, and you have a picture of your co-host.
Well, yeah, his article basically quoted a 2008 Princeton study, essentially pointing out that attractive, fit, you know, slim white women almost never date blacks. It's almost always fat white women who date blacks. So the primo white women almost never date blacks, and Jewish women almost never, ever date blacks or Asians.
So that's why you have a picture of your co-host.
Yeah, because she's Jewish, she's fit, she's hot, and I don't think you'll be finding her dating black guys.
But it's a big theme in the porn industry.
Yeah, because it's so degrading. Just like if they could make incest porn, you know, that would be huge too. So when you can produce the most shocking, or bestiality, like, you know, a lot of guys love to watch bestiality because, you know, just imagine this beautiful woman's having sex with a horse, and yeah, I know that she would never have sex with me, so it's just amazing that she'll copulate with a horse for $5,000 or $10,000. So to, when you see, you know, beautiful little blonde girls getting slammed by monster black cocks, that's a very powerful porn formula that kind of ties into, you know, nasty male sexuality in particular, which gets off on degradation. Like most erotic desires are connected to, are part and parcel of the desire to inflict some harm or to degrade, to make dirty the partner. Like the hottest sex is not when two people want to come together and unite the Holy Spirit and to worship God with their bodies as God has commanded. The hottest sex is when you have, you know, a little bit of animosity towards your partner, when you really want to stick it to your partner, a little bit of a desire to hurt your partner. Not, you know, not blood and guts, not serious, but it's a desire to sin and to make dirty that most people find is an essential part of erotic desire.
What's your opinion on someone in the porn industry like Max Hardcore?
Well, I think he makes porn as, you know, porn is naturally meant to be made, because it's, you know, erotic desire is primarily fueled by very nasty impulses, and it's not a desire to put the partner on a pedestal and worship her. That's not usually the primary fuel for erotic desire. The primary fuel for erotic desire for both men and women is to dominate, to make dirty, to hurt, to wound, to use and abuse the partner, to get back at them, to you know, grudge, take out a grudge, or to take out frustration or anger or feelings of inadequacy. these are the fuel for erotic desire. It's not the desire to love. It's not the desire to, you know, come together to glorify God.
And yeah, and your one man play again. You talked about, like, for a while, you're saying you would get in, you would watch that kind of that type of extreme porn.
Yeah, though for me, because I was writing on the industry, that largely killed my desire to watch porn. There would be times that I'd watch porn, but actually pretty rarely. You know, I'd often go, you know, well more than a year without watching any porn, because I was around it, the industry, so much that I, you know, wanted nothing more to do with it. But yeah, still the fuel in my erotic desire was basically anger that had been sexualized, which psychologists may call eroticized rage.
So we are out of time. So I'd like to thank Luke Ford for being on again.
Thanks, Robert. It was great to talk to you.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.